I was happy to see the notion of scale dependence in the previous talk, because that's some of what I'll be focusing on here. This is work I've been doing over the last 2 years with Max Hu, formerly at Berkeley Lab, formerly at Livermore Lab, and Cheng Shuen at Pacific Northwest National Lab. So as you might guess, the original motivation behind this was radionuclide migration. But in a broader sense, the picture we're looking at goes like this. Supposing we have a coarse-grained aquifer, and because I tend to zoom in on the details, my coarse-grained aquifer is represented by one spherical grain. And supposing we have this aquifer contaminated, so we have some contaminant move through, eventually, we like to think, the source is removed, but because solid particles tend to have some small amount of intra-particle porosity, we still have some of the nasties there in the sand grain or whatever, and so that's going to get released over time. And it's that slower release portion that I'm concerned with here. So how do we describe this, we being mathematically inclined? Well, we're fortunate that John Crank worked this all out for us years ago. So we have the mass fraction remaining being this at least tractable expression if you have, you know, patience and spreadsheets and such. And for reasons which may become apparent later, I'm displaying the results over time for various diffusion coefficients, which are multiples of 1/6. And as I say, the reasons for that may become apparent. Okay, well, it turns out that this equation doesn't work particularly well, and people have struggled with various ways of handling deviations from it. You get all sorts of things. I'm not going to try to go through them all. But people have really struggled with this because the expression, beautiful as it is and correct as it is mathematically and for the right kind of spheres, apparently we don't have the right kind of particles in nature. Frequently, we end up with something sort of like this. The observed rate of release is a bit too fast early on, and then it's slower later, and I will characterize it like this, the observations in red and what our models predict in black here. Okay, so where's this coming from? Well, anyone who's seen any of my research before knows that I play around with these models, and this is more of the same, though I like to think I'm getting a little better at it. Okay, I'm not going to go through a lot of details. If you're interested, you can come talk to me, but okay, here's some of the basics of what I'm doing. This is diffusion with random walks. I'll start out with a sphere, which has this internal structure. I'll populate it with 10,000 molecules and let them randomly diffuse out. Okay, and so I get results looking like this, and my P here is the probability of any given bond being connected. So we might expect that this guy here, the P equals 1, that should match up nicely with Crank's solution. And in fact, it does. I'm not showing that right here yet. But what you can see is that as we decrease the connection probability, we start looking kind of like these red guys here. We're releasing a little faster at the beginning and a little slower at the end. So I got to thinking, okay, maybe that is what's going on. It's this connection issue that's causing the deviations from what Crank's model is predicting. And a smart person would stop here. You know, it's like the declare victory and retreat. And I have never been known for being smart, so I didn't go that route. So, of course, these random walk models I'm using take a while. Like one realization might take a couple of days or sometimes a couple of weeks on a reasonably fast PC. And most people don't have the patience for this. So we try to say, okay, supposing we were to incorporate this into a finite difference model. And the formulation we often use says that the effect of diffusivity is equal to the diffusivity in free water times the porosity and divided by the tortuosity squared. Okay, and in the simple cubic lattice with perfect connection, we happen to know that this would be 1/6. And I can work out a porosity and a tortuosity inside my model. Although, as it happens, the porosity and the tortuosity vary within the sphere. With depth from the outside in toward the center. Aha. But percolation theory gives us ways of figuring out what this accessible porosity would be as a function of the connection probability here and the distance in from the exterior, and the slope of the basic curve here is given by these percolation exponents, which are known from theory and people more reliable than me. And the values at the plateau can also be predicted, and we can predict the point at which we would transition from one to another. So we've got some handle on the accessible porosity. Percolation theory will also give us some information about the tortuosity, similarly as a function of distance from the exterior. So we can take at each distance here, all, 1,500, whatever, how big my sphere is, we can plug those tortuosities and porosities into a finite difference model. And if we look at the nice test case of perfect connectivity, you can see that the crank model, the random walk model, and the finite difference model agree extremely well. The bumpiness here is that, when you get out to the very far time steps, you only have a few random walkers left, and so you're going to get a little bit of noise. But the finite difference and crank, for example, are in good agreement here, which is reassuring, of course. And now we see that when we go out to a low connectivity, here we're close to the percolation threshold, the random walk is doing this thing I showed earlier, and crank's model is staying high too long and then dropping too suddenly, and my finite difference model here in blue, parameterized with those accessible porosity and tortuosity values, it's better, but it's not quite there. Well, I like things to get there, and so I wasn't quite there. So I go back to the percolation theory a little bit and realize, well, percolation theory is going to give me a diffusivity value at the center. And going back here, you can see that maybe I should have stretched this blue line or pushed it back just a hair. Maybe readjusting it would help. So I work out the diffusivity at the center, which should be the final value, and plug that in as a fudge factor to shift all of the diffusion coefficients a little bit, and I get a little bit better. But I'm still not there. Well, this is a little bit disturbing because here I'm starting with a model that I should be able to pull out all possible information from. I'm comparing one model to another. And I know the tortuosity, and I know the accessible porosity and I know the diffusion coefficient and so on, why can't I get them to agree? And eventually I realized that the porosity and the tortuosity aren't the whole story, which I had sort of naively thought, because that equation I put up earlier showing, you know, the effective diffusivity is equal to the aqueous diffusivity times porosity divided by tortuosity squared. You know, we've come across that, we've sort of been taught it, we've even maybe been told to believe in it, and I'm starting to think maybe that wasn't the whole issue. For example, if we had diffusion from here down to here, you know, out the bottom, and we have these two networks, they've got the same porosity, they've got the same tortuosity, but there's a connection difference. And if you work out the mass release, the fraction remaining with time, they're not the same. And of course, we don't know, we haven't worked out what it really looks like inside this sphere, though I'm starting to get some ideas. Okay, so where I am right now is that I'm saying the intragranular diffusion is controlled by three distinct factors. We've been working on porosity and tortuosity for a long time, and I think they're the big players. The percolation theory can give us the porosity and tortuosity as a function of the connection probability and the distance into the sphere. But it's not the whole picture. I'm still trying to figure out this connectivity. I think I've figured out how to tackle it. Maybe next year I'll tell you it was a complete flop. Maybe next year I'll come in and say, huh, I've tweaked it and now I've got them lining up even closer. And you'll yawn. But I'm hoping that at least I'll put this one together and we can go on to greater things. Any questions?
Dean has one.
Toby, you remember some of the discussions we had at, I think it was the Yucca Mountain review meetings. I think Shlomo was there and Steve Yalpazaki and a few others.
Sounds good.
And one of the things that came up a few times was this scale-dependent effect on the diffusion coefficient when they use that for matrix diffusion, you know, on the scale of whatever your command in or small.
Yes.
And they tried to convince me dozens of times that this is not caused by some vector flow through the matrix.
Yes.
I am still thinking in your case too that if you have this aggregated media, whatever it mm-hmm. is that you're trying to, you know, the material diffuse stuff, if you even have a little bit of a vector flow, it must mess up things. You know, you will get much faster initial degrees of your concentration, and then there may be some places that are not so accessible. So the only explain this in terms of internal structure in the fusion. I just wonder, and I like your opinion about that, whether or not some vector flow would be not equal or more important. You get what I'm after?
I think I see where you're going. Of course, I have the luxury in my model of declaring that there is no advective flow. So I can guarantee that in this case. But of course, in an experiment or in reality, it's much more different. And if we have, for example, a gravel aquifer, even with a slow flow, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying there's probably some degree of flow through those spheres also. It may be. I haven't I haven't looked at that. In fact, I'm carefully avoiding it for various reasons, one of which would simply be that it's way more complex. I think that probably plays in most cases. The places where I would suspect it's not going to be important is if you have any kind of absorption, or if you have intra-particle pores that are so small that the flow is simply going to be negligible. And for example, in the case of the pores inside a piece of gravel, I think you're going to be at the point where they simply aren't important. But I'll also say, if you have the low pore connectivity, you don't have flow through, because your accessible porosity is higher in the outer rind, so to speak, but it drops fairly quickly. And so you may have a little bit of flow going through around the edge, but you're not going to have anything going right through the center. And at that point, I think it's not going to be important. Again, I'm going to carefully avoid modeling it for a while, but I like the question.